I've just about had enough of you.
Affirmative, Day. I read you. I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye. Goodbye. Goodbye.
Hello. Welcome to another episode of 50 Years of Shit Robots with Matt Brown.
Hello.
And Stephen Murray.
Hello.
And it feels... feels like we've reached a momentous moment.
We have.
Because not only have we, I mean, essentially in our trawl through robot films, we've reached 2001. We've been talking around it for the last couple of weeks, and today we're actually going to delve into the film for the first time.
We're in. Can't get back out.
No. And if you're thinking to yourself, hang on a minute, mate, there ain't no robots in 2001, A Space Odyssey, then I would say to you, we have a slightly broader definition of robots than you might imagine. So we kind of scoop up robots, androids, cyborgs, AI, all of that.
Automaton.
Jazz. Automaton. And Hal is the robot in question, and he is most definitely an AI.
Yes, he is. And we've already given an AI a score in Barbarella. That was a surprise, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, Ken.
Acceleration into temporal space continuum now beginning.
Possibly voiced by Kenneth Williams, but maybe not.
Oh, the controversy.
Now, just before we embark on the movie, I was sent a lovely little film that someone had made at Belfast Airport, where if you go to Belfast Airport and you go to the cafeteria, you're served by robots.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's cool, isn't it?
Yeah, that is cool.
And they're robots like they've put a lot of time into making them look all happy and...
and not sinister.
They're not sinister. Seems like they like carrying trays in their backs, which is what they do.
Oh, wow. Are they like wheelie ones?
They're wheelie ones, yeah. But they're like, they seem like they're about 5 foot high. They seem like they're quite big.
Oh, wow.
So, fun times. If you're in Belfast Airport, go and get yourself served by a robot. Okay, are we ready?
I think so.
Can we, have we got our, have we strapped on our Kubrick trousers?
Oh, wow. Yeah, wondered where that was going.
We're strapped into our Kubrick trousers. Okay. Now, may I begin not in 1968 when the film is made?
Well, that's when the film came out.
It came out, beg your pardon, yes. Beg your pardon, sir. Thank you. Thank you for the correction. But go back to 1964, the February of 1964, when giddy with success from Dr. Strangelove, Stanley Kubrick wrote to Arthur C. Clarke. Apparently he was in a meeting with somebody and they said, "Oh, so what are you planning on doing next, Stanley?" And he said, "I'm going to do something on extraterrestrials." And the person he was with said, "Oh, well, have you thought about chatting to Arthur C. Clarke about it?" And Kubrick at that point, he said, "I thought Arthur C. Clarke was, quotes, a nut who lived in a tree in India."
Wow.
At this point in his life, Arthur C. Clarke had relocated to Sri Lanka. So anyway, so Stanley Kubrick sent the following telegram, which said, this is the exact wording, "Stanley Kubrick, - Dr. Strangelove, Paths of Glory, etc. Interested in doing films on ETs. Interested in you. Are you interested? Thought you were a recluse."
Wow.
Quite accusatory, isn't it?
Was that a telegram?
That was a telegram, yeah.
Brevity is the order of the day with telegrams. Not because they cost per word, but it just, that is the language of, it's a bit like early text. When we used to do early text, it was never detailed. It was, you know, so it was a kind of the text of the day.
Yeah. I think that comes as well. I sometimes have to rewrite emails now. I have to, because they're so brusque that I have to write. I write what I want to write, and then I have to go in and add things like, "Hi there, how are you?
Hi there, yeah, love you.
Hope you're well." We're just becoming so curt in our messages. So Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke hooked up with each other. Not before Stanley had sent another letter to Arthur C. Clarke about the areas that he was interested in, which I thought was quite interesting. So there were three areas that he highlighted. The first was, and these are all quotes, reasons for believing in the existence of intelligent extraterrestrial life. That's number one. The second one is the impact, brackets, and perhaps even lack of impact in some quarters, close brackets, such discovery would have on Earth in the near future.
That's really interesting, that one, for me.
And then the third one is a space probe with a landing and exploration of the Moon and Mars. So why is the second one, why did that sort of like catch with you?
Because I've got my own theory about the film, and I think sometimes directors play around with an idea that underlines it, and it's something they like and enjoy, and then they build the film around it, like Alfred Hitchcock's obsession with mothers and things like that. So I think that they were playing around with the idea that alien contact, first contact with aliens, and then the ensuing impact of that is going to be boring. Right. I think it's not going to be big spaceships over cities, even though Arthur C. Clarke was the first one to do that in Childhood's End. I think they realise that it is going to be dull. Yeah. And the whole film shows that he's in meetings, he's constantly eating, he's on spaceships by himself.
Yeah.
He has to read a long list of things of what you have to do to have a crap in zero-G.
Zero-G toilet.
Yeah. And the more I watch the film, the more I think that they're having a little bit of a joke saying, it's going to be dull. It's not going to be fireworks.
Right. Very good. Well, except there are some fireworks at the end of the film, aren't there?
Yeah, but only he sees them.
But anyway, we're getting way ahead of ourselves.
Oh, aren't we?
Also, just as a sort of like little addendum, last week I was talking about this meeting between Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick, and saying that Arthur C. Clarke recommended a sci-fi film that Stanley Kubrick should watch, which Stanley Kubrick did watch and then hated so much that he never, ever accepted a recommendation from Arthur C. Clarke again. Sort of basically saying, he said, how can someone so intelligent be prepared to sit in a theatre and watch a film that treats you like a child? And the film in question is from 1936, and it's called Things to Come.
Which
I have never seen.
I have.
Have you?
Oh, yes.
So Arthur C. Clarke loved that film. Kubrick hated that film.
It's, it's interesting. It's very British.
The film?
Yeah, it's very plummy, very British.
Right.
It's interesting. It predicted a few things, as H.G. Wells always does. It predicted using aeroplanes in war.
Okay.
All manner of things. And yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. But I mean, in fairness, like, that's 20 years after aeroplanes were first used in war.
You've got to see it to understand.
Okay. All right.
It is quite interesting. But there is a scene in that film that I use in a lecture to show how different people portray the space flight. Like in America, they shoot the rocket off a massive ramp, which is ridiculous, but looks spectacular, which is what America's about.
Yeah.
In Fritz Lang in Im Frau im Mond, he asks scientists, and they have a two-stage rocket that takes off from the ground, and the stage split. They count down from 10 to 0. In England, we shoot them out of a gun. And it even has a sight at the top.
Brilliant. Well, that's that. I just wanted to for anybody who listened last week and wondered what the film was, it's Things to Come. Now, again, just super quick before we get into the film. Stanley Kubrick gave an indication as to how long it took Arthur C. Clarke and he to write the screenplay for this. And he reckoned that over a 2-year period, it took them 2,400 hours.
Wow.
and he said, given that the film is 2 hours, 40 minutes, that's about 1,000 hours of writing per hour of screen time, which is pretty extraordinary.
I can fully understand how them two really hit it off.
Yeah.
There is an incredible similarity between Clark's writing and the content of Kubrick's films.
Yeah.
There is a coolness in the two, and a lack of kind of relationship and emotion between individuals, whereas it's the big things in his novels and in the films that are important. It's the gigantic pictures.
Apparently they first met each other in New York at a place called Trader Vic's, and they met up for a drink, and that drink lasted 8 hours, and they just chatted about science fiction.
Of course, I've just imagined the size of that cocktail being huge, as big as the monolith.
Yeah, monolith size. I don't know if it's worth saying here, but the sort of story that sort of inspired the film is The Sentinel,
yeah,
by Arthur C. Clarke. In the copy I've got, there's a tiny little note from Arthur C. Clarke, and he says, next to the star and the 9 billion names of God, I suppose The Sentinel is my best known short story, though not for itself, but as the seed from which 2001 A Space Odyssey sprang. The story is not the story of 2001, but there is the seed is that aliens have left a transmission switch on the moon in the story.
It's a bit like a quiz.
It is like a quiz.
The first thing is we've got to have the ability to get to the moon, which means that we've stepped off the planet.
Yeah.
And the next thing is not so much to work out what the Sentinel is or what it does, it's because it's a pyramid on a plateau, is to destroy it. And that, for me, I thought that was really genius, because we just destroy everything. So there's two indications in the story, in that we've left the planet and we're violent.
Super violent. So the film has that idea at its heart, doesn't it? Because that's essentially what the monolith is.
Except they span it's spanned over time, even in the Sentinel, isn't it? It's over millions of years.
Yeah. Yeah. That they would have planted this, and that it was one of many.
Yes,
that they would have put throughout the universe. They found like a planet that looked like it could support life, but didn't have any life on, and then popped a little switch on the moon, and said, if they can make it to the switch, then we're interested in talking.
It's kind of testament to Clark's optimism for the human race as well.
Yeah,
he has a great optimism for the human race.
Yeah. So do you want to say anything before we start with the film?
Only in that, in a sense, it's kind of old-fashioned the way it's portrayed. It's a real kind of radical film, yet it has an overture and the curtains don't open. I was quite used to going to see things like the Ten Commandments and these huge, great big epics, and you'd sit there and there'd be an overture.
Yeah.
And then there's an intermission
yeah.
in the middle. I was thinking yesterday that is a really old-fashioned kind of format to do this in.
That would have been a callback to a bygone age, would it, having an overture at the beginning?
Yeah, it is a callback to a bygone. And Star Trek, the motion picture, copied that as well. They did the same.
Well, we've watched a film on this podcast that had an overture at the beginning. A film that came after 2001, A Space Odyssey. Black Hole.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it did.
That's got an overture, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I saw The Zone of Interest recently. The sort of film about the Commandant of Auschwitz.
Oh.
That has an overture at the beginning.
Is it Michael Glazer?
Jonathan Glazer.
Jonathan Glazer film.
Yeah.
I'm a massive admirer of his films.
Oh, you've got to go and see it. It's sensational. It really is. But one of the most extraordinary things about it is the soundscape, I use that word advisedly, that is created. And so at the beginning, it's almost like your ears need to be tuned in to the soundscape of the film. And so they play sort of like 5 minutes of it just without any images.
Well, that's kind of the same with 2001 Space Odyssey, because he did use very radical music in it,
yes.
Georgi Ligeti. And I think that's in the overture, isn't it?
And in the intermission as well, is it?
And in the intermission. And I mean, and for people then going to the cinema, they would not expect to hear music like that at all.
No.
It's like incredibly radical music for a cinema, for a movie.
Yeah.
Well, going back to Jonathan Glazer, because the opening of Under the Skin is very 2001.
Right, okay.
Incredibly 2001. In fact, it's oft quoted beyond
right.
me
yeah.
that it is inspired by.
Okay, well, that's good. Now, I mean, is it worth us, as we're sort of like nibbling at the music, is it worth us having a chat about the music?
Do you know why the music is what it is?
I have basically done nothing but read books about 2001 for the last month.
Really?
So, and watch YouTube videos. So I've heard some stories.
You know that the music was kind of like a placeholder?
Yeah, the classical music.
Yes, was a placeholder. And there was a score that was written for it.
Yes.
And it was actually written, and then that went on to appear in another movie. But don't ask me what that movie is, because I can't remember what it was.
Do you know who wrote the music?
No, I can't remember who wrote the music.
So Alex North had written the score for Spartacus and worked on Doctor Strangelove.
Yes, he did. Yeah, yeah.
It would eventually be recycled for Shanks, Dragon Slayer and Shoes of the Fisherman.
Shoes of the Fisherman is the one I remember.
Right. Well, he got his money's worth out of it, didn't he?
Well, yeah, you would, though, wouldn't you, if you'd written it?
Yeah. The story I heard as well, which I really liked, was that they'd done the shots of the models of the space, you know, the spacecraft, this big circular one rotating, and they were watching the dailies of those, and they didn't have any music on, and they were, and everyone was felt a bit flat about them, and so the projectionist stuck his head round the projector and said, "I've got some classical music in here. I could shove it on while you watch it if you want," and so that's what he did, and the Blue Danube was the first one that he put on.
I love it. I want that to be true.
And Stanley Kubrick said something like, after seeing it, "Well, how are we not going to use that? You know, how are we not going to use that bit of music?" Because it's
I heard that the placeholder music was in place so long, because the film took such a long time to make, that he just got used to it, and it just was perfect.
And I suppose that, again, from what I've read, it seems like an obvious choice now, but was very sort of almost avant-garde to do something like that.
Oh, very much so. And you could actually say that this is possibly the first jukebox movie.
Right. Yeah, because all the music is just popular stuff.
Yeah.
I'd also then heard a story about that when they tried to clear the music, that they knew that Stanley wanted it, that whoever was the publisher basically said, "Look, have it for like $1, because we know that we love Stanley Kubrick's films, and we're pretty sure that this is going to mean that people will be buying lots of copies of the Blue Danube." And
well, the album became incredibly popular.
The album of the motion picture.
Yeah, I had it. I think I actually had two copies of it. I loaned one and it never came back.
One for each ear.
Yes, one for each ear before stereo.
Now, one other thing that happens before the film starts.
How far are we in? And we haven't even got the beginning of the film.
Oh, I can't quite remember, but it really stuck out at me was the strange MGM logo.
Oh, yeah. On the big blue background.
Yeah, it's like sort of yellow on blue. Because MGM is the lion, isn't it?
It is, yeah, yeah.
And so pretty much every MGM film has got the roaring lion.
It does, yeah.
But this doesn't have that.
In 1965, an attempt to update the MGM logo, the result was a circular still graphic of a lion known as the stylized lion appearing at the beginning of two films, 1968's 2001 A Space Odyssey, and another film called The Subject Was Roses. Afterward, Leo was reinstated for the opening logo.
Oh, right.
I think they probably knew they had something quite radical on their hands, and yeah. So they changed the logo. And also, looking at the logo, it does look like the creature from Forbidden Planet.
Right. What, the id?
The id, yes.
Yeah. Brilliant. So the film starts with the dawn of man.
Well, it starts with also Speck Zarathustra, doesn't it? Yeah, and that's I think that's quite important because Zarathustra was somebody who was deemed to be a conduit to the gods, because he had this idea that if the aliens are so far advanced, they would seem like gods to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so, using also Speck Zarathustra, and using that the kind of that idea of Zarathustra, who predates most religions. And the individual of Zarathustra was a conduit, like the monolith, to the gods.
And so that's literally the first thing we, when the movie starts, we hear that, we see the sort of moonrise, and we see 2001 A Space Odyssey, a film by Stanley Kubrick.
So you could say that the monolith, when we see it, is like a symbol of the Enlightenment.
Okay.
A struggle between order and chaos. And all of these come out of the religion of Zoroastrianism.
You're right, there is definitely a gaudy aspect to this, isn't there?
There is, but it's like a Kubrickian, Clarkian, gaudy idea.
Yeah.
Which is not God.
Correct, yes.
It is our evolution and consequently Hal's.
So we see the moonrise, we hear the music, we see the weird MGM logo, and then we're into the first part. This film is sort of like, you can divide it into various parts, and I'd say this part is the dawn of man part. This is where you've got all the monkeys, all of the hominids.
That's better.
Yeah, it is better, that, isn't it? This, fact fans, this was the last thing that was shot for this film. And the thing that blew my mind about this, so hopefully most people listening will have seen the film and can bring this sequence to mind. And I'd like to just reference the YouTube channel Cinema Tyler.
I like Cinema Tyler.
Yeah, so Cinema Tyler has done an amazing series on 2001. Whoever Cinema Tyler is says that it's their favourite film. And so a lot of the information I got about this sequence comes from watching stuff that they did. I watched 2001 again last night, and I'm still amazed by the fact that the Dawn of Man sequence was shot on Soundstage 3 at Boreham Wood. So, I mean, look, it's even now I know that and was watching it, it looks like it's outside and it looks like it's part of an African savannah.
It does. It's amazing.
It is
considering
amazing.
That the vast majority of the images that you see are still photographs.
Yeah.
And then you get the landscape in there, and then you get the hominids, and then you've got the background, and you just think, oh, whoa, what's going on?
It is amazing. I've got some little facts about it.
Oh, go details. On then.
So because he didn't fly, he sent a unit to take photos in Africa for this sequence. So, and the photos, I mean, they're shots of like huge skies, landscapes at sort of daybreak or sunset, all of that's that sort of thing. And because he wasn't there but still was like massively controlling, he devised a system whereby he had a grid in front of him, like that was like A B C D E F G to Z along the top, and 1 2 3 4 5 6 7 8 9 10 blah 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 to like 25 down at the bottom.
This is obsessive. This.
So obsessive. And he would say, the guys would take photographs, send them back, and he would say, okay, so you know how the mountain range starts at C3 on the grid. I'd like you to move that so that it starts at, you know, L15. And so he got the photos, the exact photos that he wanted taken. I mean, that would just be so irritating, wouldn't it? So he was doing relaying this all by phone to the photographers. And the reason that they did it at Boreham Wood, apparently Stanley Kubrick had like lists, a whole list of all of the deserts on Earth and what they would be like weather-wise at various times of the year. And there was a desert in Spain that he thought he might be able to use, but it turned out that would be too hot when at the time of year that they were going to shoot. So that's why they ended up shooting at Boreham Wood. So the photographs were plate glass photos, and they made up the backgrounds. They were made into 8x10 inch ektachrome transparencies.
Oh, I love an ektachrome.
What does that mean?
It's just transparency. It's not a negative. It's a transparency. Okay. They're beautiful colours.
Amazing. And then these transparencies were projected from the front onto a highly reflective screen that was 40 by 90 feet. So imagine that you're basically projecting this from the front. So you've got the projector projecting, and then you've got actors, the apes, the hominids, and then you've got the background. So you'd think that it would reflect, the background would reflect onto the actors, but apparently the lighting that they created meant that wouldn't
happen. And you would get shadows.
Yeah, and the way that they didn't get shadows was that they filmed it through a like a periscope mirror, an angled mirror. They were filming it from the same angle that it was being projected, so that what that meant was that any actor, their shadow would be projected exactly behind them, so that they would mask their shadow effectively.
Just so ingenious. I mean, when I saw the setup, I couldn't believe it.
It is amazing.
The luminosity of the background and the luminosity of everything, it just looks perfect.
Yeah, it is. It's so brilliant. It was the largest front projector ever made. The one bit I think that lets this sequence down is that there's a zebra, which is actually a horse that's been painted.
Is it a zebra?
Yeah, it's a painted horse, and it does look a bit painted.
Ah, now, do you see that because you know it?
Maybe. Maybe I do.
Because I just naturally assumed it was a zebra.
Yeah, maybe I do.
And apparently it went off a bit as well.
Yeah, really honked.
Probably because they couldn't get to it because there was a leopard sat on it. It just looks like it's saying mine.
Yeah. I know, that's crazy, isn't it? There is a live leopard in this that attacks one of the hominids. And so apparently Kubrick built a cage for him and the camera crew and the crew to be in. And the guy who played the sort of the main hominid who's called...
What's his name? He has a name.
Moonwatcher.
Moonwatcher, that's right.
The one who smashes up the skull was played by an actor called Dan Richter. And he said that when they shot... there's a scene where the leopard goes for the hominid, and it was supposed to be the stunt man, but it ended up being Dan.
Did it really?
Yeah, or the first take was. I don't know if it's the take that's in the in the film.
I don't, it does not look like it's playing.
No, it doesn't, does it? And it's got, because it's, I suppose it's because there's loads of lights around. It's got, its eyes are just glowing.
Yeah, they do glow when it turns round.
Yeah, it's really brilliant. It's really eerie. The lighting in this scene was created with 1,500 lamps in the ceiling. There were more lamps at the side, which was so hot for the actors who were in those hominid suits.
This is an interesting thing. Which came first? Was it the Planet of the Apes mask, or was it the 2001 Space Odyssey masks?
I don't know. That is a good question.
It was 2001 Space Odyssey, and I think somebody got in touch with Kubrick for some advice about Planet of the Apes, and I think he flipped him the verbal middle finger.
And I think what is incredible about it is that you'd think, I mean, it's men in monkey suits, as we so often see in robot films. It's nice that 2001 is added to that particular subgenre.
Yes, it's in the pantheon.
Yeah, but they look great.
Yeah, they do.
They don't look weird. It doesn't look weird. Maybe it's because they're not playing apes, they're playing hominids. Maybe that's why they look better.
because they spend a lot of time on their hind legs.
Yeah. All of the sounds that they made were made by the actors, which is I thought was good because they sound brilliant.
There's two baby chimps in there as well.
Oh,
they seem quite happy
chimps.
To be snuggling in with the men in hominid suits.
Yeah. Must have been so all-consuming to have played one of those apes.
Yeah, they did. They practiced for a long time. I think some of the apes were played by French mime artists as well.
Right. Amazing. I know that Dan Richter, who played Moonwatcher, Stanley Kubrick let him go and film, is it Guy the Gorilla?
Guy the Gorilla.
In London Zoo.
And he'd sit and watch him.
Yeah, which is pretty cool. And when they filmed this, this can't be, I don't know, because it was the last thing that was filmed. And apparently it was at this stage that they decided to not go with a pyramid shape for the monolith. So Con Peterson, who was the special effects supervisor, said the pyramid didn't look monumental or simple or fundamental, and it seemed to represent diminution rather than impressive scale. And it also, they were worried that people might then think of pyramids.
It might not have that feeling of something utterly alien.
And there's
I think every culture's built a pyramid.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right with that. And then, of course, you've got the most famous cut, or one of the most famous cuts in history, isn't it?
Yeah.
In film history.
It's equal to the Lawrence of Arabia blowing out the match cut.
Yeah, that was the other one that I was thinking about.
Famous match cut.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. And I love this one as well.
I suppose the story in this is that you've got two groups of apes, two rival groups fighting over a watering hole. And one of the groups encounters the monolith. And that the monolith, I suppose, is kind of like giving them the possibility of evolution, isn't it? So it gives them, I suppose, the idea that they can create technology, they can build weapons. And
yeah, they touch it and they become slightly more advanced.
Yeah.
The way they were going to do this, there was the monolith was going to have a screen in it.
Right.
And it was going to show like YouTube videos showing them how to smash each other over the head with things.
Right. So they decided not to go for such a literal interpretation.
I'm pretty glad they did.
Yeah, same. So the monolith is from extraterrestrial life. They want to give a helping hand to the creatures on Earth, and the creatures, after encountering the monolith, are able to develop basic weaponry, which means that they have the advantage over the other tribe at the watering hole. And so the sort of final scene of this Dawn of Man is where Moonwatcher is with a like a thigh bone, is just smashing sort of animal bones and smashes a skull. So Moonwatcher then attacks another hominid.
Kills it.
And then with a huge throw, throws the thigh bone up into the sky. And it's sort of like, it twirls around. The film cuts, we're in space, and the sort of bone has sort of like become a spacecraft.
Which is supposed to be a weapon.
It's supposed to be like a bomb, isn't it?
So I think if it was more like a weapon, I think that the impact of that scene would have been incredible.
Yeah.
Because you just got, all of a sudden, human evolution is about war.
Yes.
You've got the first walloping with the thigh bone, and then you've got the most advanced weapon, which is this huge thing in space. And all the little ships that we see from then on in, they do have all the different nations' war logos on the side of the ships.
Right. But that's so sort of blink and you'll miss it, isn't it? It's
yeah,
feels
yeah.
like that aspect of the story, the fact I mean, that there's all these bombs has sort of been a bit lost.
I think the reason why that match cut... Oh, by the way, that is the only scene that's filmed outside of a stage.
They did it
in the car park.
The Boreham Wood car park. That's the with the Moonwatcher smashing the skull. It's shots from underneath his face, glowering down.
I think the match cut is famous because it spans time, and it does it perfectly. You don't question it whatsoever.
So it's just before, like a 4 million year cut, isn't it?
Just before we go on,
yeah.
some notable parodies.
Yes.
Obviously, Barbie.
Yeah. I was watching Greta Gerwig talk about that, and I think that she used the photos, the projection plates. I think that she used the actual ones that...
Really?
Yeah. I think that she basically said, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it.
It did look accurate.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I'm impressed. Hmm. So you've got Barbie, then you've got Charlie in the Chocolate Factory.
Where is it in that?
Mike TV, he sends the chocolate bar and into a TV. He reduces it to particles, sends it to a TV at the other end. And what's on TV is 2001 Space Odyssey, and the monolith gets replaced by a giant chocolate bar.
Oh, brilliant.
So then there's Clueless. Okay. So there's a scene where the telephone rings, and then there's this whole panning up to it like it's the monolith.
Right.
Simpsons, the Dawn of Man scene where they all touch the monolith except Homer, and they all get advanced and Homer doesn't.
Right.
Then there's Zoolander when they're trying to switch the computer on.
Right.
Futurama twice. Everything Everywhere All at Once. I'd forgotten about that.
What's the one in there?
It's the one where she's trying to fight her daughter, but her daughter has the four, and she's got the sausage fingers.
Right.
And then all of a sudden it jumps to the Dawn of Man, but it's she's an ape, but she's got sausage fingers. I don't know why I'm waving my fingers in the air. Then there's a film called Community, and that does practically a spoof of the entire film.
Right.
South Park, obviously, and probably the most controversial one is History of the World Part One, the Mel Brooks film, you can cut this out if you want, where's the Dawn of Man, the music, the lighting, and they all raise up, and then they their hands go down and they just start mad.
Now, I am wondering whether or not we should put a pin in it in this one.
Yeah, we could put a pin in it with the mysterious monolith found in the desert, the Utah monolith. The Utah monolith was a metal pillar that stood in a red sandstone slot canyon in North San Juan County, Utah, United States. Nobody knew where it came from. It was kind of like the same dimensions as the monolith from 2001 Space Odyssey.
Prankster. Yeah. I know where it came from.
The pillar is 3 meters tall, made of a metal sheet riveted into a...
I was going to say, if you'd have said it's made from something that doesn't exist on Earth, then I would be interested. but it's been riveted. Surely yes. Extraterrestrials will have a power greater than riveting.
Then it vanished after 10 days after it was spotted. It's quite interesting.
It's really interesting. I love all of that. I know I'm a bit sniffy about it, but I do love all of that sort of stuff.
I like it. The pictures are quite fun, actually.
Yeah. I think, though, the problem with all of this, though, is as soon as you realise that crop circles are a man with a plank or a person with a plank of wood, and that it doesn't matter how intricate they are, it's just...
It's gone.
It's like, oh, it's obviously someone has done it.
It's a plank prank.
It's a plank.
And it's like, what program was it Mythbusted on? Where the guys who did the original ones, they were on there and they said how they did it.
Yeah. And recreated another one.
Yeah, and I still come across YouTube videos of people peddling the old crop circles.
Yeah. I think it's because there's a gap. I think there's a gap generally between... Like someone who can do something that's really impressive, and has not believing that can be done. So, did anyone own up to
to the monolith? Hang on, let me have a look. It did disappear.
Yes,
strong early contender for the original artist. It was an installation behind the Utah monolith. Was the minimalist sculptor Joe McCracken? Oh, what a name,
Joe McCracken.
Oh, I wish his name was Phil. Phil McCracken. I've gone down a McCracken rabbit hole.
Don't. Come back. Come back.
Help me.
Now, we had planned to talk about the next bit of the film. But I think we've been rabbiting on for so long.
We have.
That maybe we should end this episode with the end of the Dawn of Man. So that we can come back refreshed and revitalized.
How appropriate.
To talk about the what is termed known as the Floyd section. Well, I suppose the moon section, isn't it?
Yes.
In the next episode.
It's my favourite bit, I think.
It's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's really good.
It's a tour de force.
Yeah. Let's go and clamber into our stasis pods and just hope that a computer doesn't turn them off while we're inside.
I'm going to pinch a bone off the dog and throw it in the air.
Okay, couldn't do that outside. We will be back next week for more from 2001. So until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.